And we are live about 5 minutes early today. Nick got into the green room early, and I'm like, you know what? Nick made a point. It's better to be early than late. There's even a guy that wrote a book, and the first chapter is about that. So here we go. We're rolling a little bit early today. Hopefully it doesn't bother anyone. Anyway, I got Nick Ferguson in the green room right now. We're going to talk about building resilient homesteads with Nick. Most of you guys know who Nick is. If you don't, when he comes on, we'll have him introduce himself a little bit to you. But Nick and I go pretty far back. I think the first time Nick and I hung out together was about 2013, I'm going to guess. It was right after I moved into our current home. We had a little get-together after a prepper convention, and Nick came by and brought me some beer, some really good beer that comes in a big bottle with a cork on top of it. That was a good way into the Spearco fold, and we just hit it off, and we've been working together ever since. And I'd like to think that we've learned a lot from each other. It's a two-way stream. And he's really one of the best consultants in homesteading and permaculturing that I've met in, you know, doing this now for, it'll be 17 years in June. And we'll have him on in just a minute to tell you all about building that resilient homestead and some things he's got coming up that you might want to be part of. Before we do that, let's hear from our sponsors of the day. And I have a couple announcements for you today. Number one, sponsor of the day, number one today, JM Bullion. I am a Bitcoin bull. I don't believe there is a second best, but I do believe there is a place for diversity. And that diversity to me involves something that is unique in its property, something that I can take in my hand, put in somebody else's hand, and no one needs to know about it, including the turtle sitting on top of the fence post. Doesn't need to know about it. That's what silver and gold do. They have a multi-thousand-year history as monetary instruments. They are difficult to counterfeit. If not, honestly, they're impossible if you take a good look at them. And the whole point of silver and gold is it's the same. No matter what you have, silver eagle's a silver eagle, a gold eagle's a gold eagle, that type of thing. So there's no reason to pay extra for it because you feel better because, I don't know, the brand name of the company you bought it from. So go to JM Bullion, where you'll get the absolute best price, better than Monex, Apmex, Lear Capital. All of those guys have come to me and asked to sponsor the show over the year. And you know what they got told? No. Wasn't really a price issue. It's not that big of a price difference. It's because I said, well, who can I talk to if there's a problem? Some low-level peon. No, that doesn't work. When I talk to JM Bullion about bringing them on, they're like president of the company. I'm like, well, that works. So that's why JM Bullion has been with us now since, well, about as long as I've known Nick Ferguson. That's about how long they've been around as a sponsor. That is a long damn time in the world of podcasting, folks. Next up today, someone hasn't been around as long, but been around for quite a while with us and is an excellent company to do business with, Start9 Private Servers. How about you take back your technology? How about you take back your freedom? How about you actually own your own data and instead of letting a trusted third party take care of your data for you, where you know damn well they can cut you off from it or they can sell it? And they do both of those things frequently. With Start9, you can run your own independent private messaging service for you, your family, your friends, and your community. You can run a Bitcoin node, you can run a Lightning node, and you can do a ton of other things, and it's easy. If you can install apps on a smartphone and use them, then you can use a Start9 box. They'll ship it right to your house. Plug it in, follow the instructions. It's easy to do. And remember, when you're using Start9, if you're going to buy from them, you can get a discount of 9% if you're an MSB member, and you can stack another discount on top of it if you're a Fold Card user, and both of those discounts will work for you and let you stack sats at the same time. So check them out, start9.com. With that, let me bring my good friend and special guest today, Nick Ferguson, on. Nick, welcome to the show again.
Thanks for having me every time.
You know, most of this audience knows you because not only have you been on the show many times, taught at almost all my workshops, you're also an expert council member. But we do have new people that tune in every day. So kind of just give people a little bit of your backstory. You know, you didn't always have that giant-ass beard and that Gen Z haircut. but you have been doing the type of thing we're going to talk about today for most of your life.
Right, yeah. So I guess the kind of the shorter version I grew up a homeschooler. We grew up homesteading. I was born in Dallas, so Texan to the bone. But pretty soon we moved to the family property in Ohio, almost 300 acres. And I grew up taking care of critters. I grew up with aquariums. And so from the very, very beginning, you know, my whole learning focus, everything that we were about, my parents, you know, homeschooling me, was ecosystems, ecology. So, because, you know, you keep aquariums, you know, you've got to have things in balance or things get out of whack. And so, you know, anything from terrariums to saltwater to freshwater, you know, that was my jam from, you know, I could barely talk. I was doing that stuff. And then fast forward, you get into some more adult concerns, and you got, you know, the 08 real estate issues, and, you know, just paying attention to what's going on in the world and recognizing what is where the failure points are, where the weak points are, and realizing, hey, all of this could come crumbling down really, really easily. And so, you know, I started focusing a lot more on the homesteading side of things and the self-sufficiency. Came across your show, and it didn't take me very long to realize, man, this guy's really switched on. He knows what he's talking about. And I was a home brewer at the time, and I was like, you know, I need to be in this guy's life. In some way, we are going to work together. I know it. And so, so I'd been studying all those BJCP beer styles, and I listened to what you said. I paid attention and some of the things that you liked. And I was like, I know what kinds of beers he's going to like. And then, just kind of slotted into, just serving the TSP community. That's really what got my foot in the door. And you recognize that. That was one of the first things that you noticed.
So guys, like if somebody just tried to do what he did and that's all they did, they probably would have got thrown out on their ear. But like when he first started coming to my workshops, it'd be 3 o'clock in the morning and he's still sitting in front of a whiteboard with somebody working on their property and not charging them for it. And it was like, dude, put the fucking marker down and have a beer with me before I go to bed. Cause I got to go to bed. I got to be up tomorrow at 6 a.m. to get this shit going again. And I'm going to get 3 hours of sleep. So let's chill. And it's just the heart of the teacher. And it's kind of why I've always looked at Nick as like quite younger brother. but your homegrown Liberty brand that you've established is awesome, but it's about practical homesteading. What's the core of your approach and how is it different than just, you know, the blanket term permaculture?
Yeah. So, you know, you and I have talked about this, you know, some of the foibles of the permaculture community at large. There seems to be, with a lot of permaculture enthusiasts, I'm trying not to paint with a broad brush and label everybody, but a lot of people that are really hardcore permaculture permy type people, they're kind of lefty, greeny weeny, a lot more concerned with things outside of our sphere of influence. Mm-hmm. And they have massive spheres of concern.
Yeah.
And relatively small spheres of influence. And they're not focusing on those things that they can actually do in their backyards. You know, you and I started a huge Facebook group just because of that problem. So what I've always tried to focus on, I take the best parts of permaculture, of, you know, Mark Shepard's type stuff, of Ben Falk's, all of these different, you know, key line design, all of these different design sciences. And I've tried to amalgamate them into something that is less concerned with what is happening on the other side of the world. Cause while it may be a concern, there's practically nothing I can do about it. So it's all about what can we do right in our backyard? What can I do to get my family as self-sufficient and as resilient as humanly possible? And, you know, I reject the whole lone wolf, you know, beans, bullets and band-aids. I'm just going to stack stuff. And when it all hits the fan, I'm just going to go scavenge off of everybody else. I don't like that, which is something that I love about the community that you've created. It's community. it's not lone wolfness. It is about, you know, reaching out to your neighbors, your local community, building up as much resiliency around you as you possibly can. So, you know, on the kind of the practical core, you know, I've talked to you about this for numerous years about, you know, teaching a PDC possibly. And, mm-hmm. and one of my big concerns with the PDCs are that it is like, it's drinking from a fire hose and you're skimming across the tops of all of these mountain peaks with a mm-hmm. PDC. And you're getting this huge overarching, structure of knowledge that touches on a whole bunch of things, but all of the really practical foundational stuff is just glossed over. And, yeah. and my concern with teaching a PDC and accepting $2,000 for this okay. class yeah. is, it seems like a lot of people that sign up for this stuff, they're hoping to get the practical hands-on stuff. How do I actually get my chickens, you know, self-sufficient on my property? And while the design science, you know, the permaculture design science is fantastic, I feel like it's a jumping off point that gets people excited, but mm-hmm. there's not a whole heck of a lot of the nuts and bolts and practicality stuff. So that's what I like to focus on, getting the foundational systems in place that we can actually success out to being able to take advantage of those more mountaintop peaks.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, I have the same issue. We've talked about it many times, just personally, not on, yeah. on the air, about the limitations of a PDC. And one of the ways I look at it is, imagine you wanted to build a tiny home on your property. Well, you need to learn how to do framing, find a good site to put it in the first place, mm-hmm. how to do paneling, how to do interior finish. There's a whole litany of things you need to learn how to do. But what you don't need to know how to do is go to architecture school.
Right.
And learn how to design 20 different styles of buildings and Gothic arches and steel frame and, you know, the latest in eco technology along with conventional electrical wiring. Like, you need to learn how to build a freaking tiny home because that's what you want.
Right.
You got this homesteader that's brand new, so they're not really a homesteader yet. They just have their place. Maybe they have mm-hmm. a few failed projects. They want a flock of birds that doesn't screw everything up and crap on the porch. They want them to stay alive. They want to get production mm-hmm. out of them that is sufficient, that you're not basically paying three times as much for eggs. You want to pay the same or less for a better egg. You want, you know, a garden that produces. You want a rotational pattern that works for you as far as where you plant, when you plant. Maybe you want, I don't know, a little foraging area. Maybe you want some trees and a little orchard. That's, you know what you want. And the value of a PDC is, if you really take it seriously, you might figure out some of those things you don't want, or the way that you organize them is different. But I always like, I mean, it's more for a course as a foundation, because it's not enough by itself. A foundation for somebody's going to operate as a consultant.
Right.
Right. It is not a course for the person that wants what we just said. And then there's 100 different ways that people would lay that out.
Right.
And each one's unique. And that's the whole point of a PDC, is with this overriding concept, you can design it, but that person knows what they want. Mm-hmm. So what they need is to build it and to know how to build it. And if they need something beyond that, it's way less expensive and more efficient for them to reach out to an experienced consultant like you than to take a $2,000 PDC only to realize, wow, so Yoda taught me to move the rock, but I can't uh-huh. do shit with it yet, right? Like, I don't even yeah. know how to build my lightsaber, and I think I'm a Jedi, but I just basically became a junior Padawan, right? Because that's yeah. what you are when you come out of a PDC, if you don't have other life experiences to put with it. Now, if you have a lot of experience, you've built a lot of homestead stuff, you've worked with a lot of plants, you know a lot of these things already, then it's like, everything opens, your brain goes, oh my God, look what I can do with what I know. Mm-hmm. But if you put the cart before the horse there, then I think a lot of people go to a PDC and they think, I'm going to come home, I'm going to put my garden in, and they come home and they go, I don't actually know anything about a garden that I didn't already know, except maybe that I was stupid about my solar aspect. That okay, I learned that, right?
Yep.
You know, don't put it this way, put it that way. But like, what plants do you plant? No information whatsoever. None. Right. You know, I look at it like composting, it's in there, they talk about it. I did a compost course for one kind of composting. It's 6 hours of instruction.
Right.
But you can't fold that into an 80-hour PDC. You can't spend 5 hours on composting.
No, so you can just tell someone they need to compost.
Right. It might be one of the most important things for your long-term sustainability that you can know is how to make compost, how to take care of compost so you don't kill it. Because you mentioned aquariums. I tell people in the course, pretend it's a fish tank. If the fish tank dries out, all the fish die. There's no oxygen in the water, all the fish die. If a bad bacterium gets in there, all the fish die, right? You have to have everything in balance. It has to be cared for. Mm-hmm. You can't do that in 80-hour PDC. You got too much to cover.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so...
That doesn't mean either one of us doesn't think you shouldn't take one. Just, you should know what you're getting.
Right, right. And you know... You know me, I like to give actionable information.
Yeah.
You know, you and I are both, you know, big on actionable information. I want you to get the information that you need to actually move forward, not just think about it, not just have dreams, but to actually do something and move forward and actually make progress.
Yeah. Yeah. So you have a big announcement too.
Yeah,
I'll just leave it to you. You can tell people about it because you got a big announcement.
I'm really pumped. So, we have been looking for land for quite a while. I actually looked at potentially getting some land out closer to you at one point. We've looked at Tennessee, Oklahoma, even. You know, several different places. I was mostly leaning towards Tennessee.
Okay.
And at the last workshop, I was sitting down, just kind of catching up with some of the longtime, you know, repeat offenders that keep coming to the workshops for some god awful reason. I don't know why people keep coming to these workshops every November. And so I'm sitting there at the, you know, the lunch table, and, you know, people are asking, you know, what's going on, what's new, and what's been happening with the Fergusons for the last year. And so Harry's sitting there. And for those of you who don't know who Harry is, he's fantastic. He's been at, I don't know how many of the workshops. He's helped with several of them, and he's a real smart guy. Real great guy. And he let me know that he's got some extra land in East Texas. And I was like, I like Texas.
Yeah.
I like extra land.
What is this extra land you speak of?
Yeah, yeah. So I ended up stopping by on my way home. And dude... It's perfect, Jack. I don't know. Have you ever been out there?
I know the area really well, so I know the landform and land type, but okay. I've not been to the place, yeah.
It is like the little brother to Kentucky with the landform, with those rolling hills. It's beautiful. Yeah, so we're looking at getting out there, hopefully, in this upcoming, not this summer, but next summer.
Okay.
If things go really well this year, that might be sooner. We'll just see how it goes. But yeah, 40 acres. It is almost all in pasture. It is going to lay out beautifully for swales, for silvopasture. I've already been dreaming up exactly how I want to lay everything out. And yeah, it's been, man, 10 years on family land. So we've been on family land that's been held in a family trust. And so, you know, one of the big issues out here has been kind of the, you know, death by committee issues. You know, when you got a whole bunch of family involved in whether or not we're putting a barn on the property or what have you, it, it really slows everything down. So, man, 100% me doing exactly what I want on this property, exactly where and when I want to do it. Oh, this is going to be exciting. Starting from scratch, you know, a clean canvas. We're putting in, like I said, swales. We're doing silvopasture. We're doing overstory, long-term carbohydrate drop integrated into those pastures. I've got a really, really cool set of, you know, detailed plans for that. I think you're going to really dig it when I show you what I'm talking about. But fodder trees are going to be a big thing. I have not come across very many properties in the USA. I can't tell you. I've been on, it's over 1,000 people's properties at this point. I stopped counting years ago and I used to be able to run through them all and remember every single one of them. I can't do that anymore. I can't come close to remembering them all, but I have not been to a single piece of property where there was more than a few dozen trees planted and being used for fodder. And I want to get at least an acre under production with fodder trees. And one of my big goals is to show, to demonstrate exactly what you can accomplish when the foundation of your fertility system is, you know, silvopasture and fodder trees. So that's really exciting. I want to be the premier spot to see how those systems function and work and how to design them and implement them on your own properties.
And what's cool is you talked about finding property closer to me. It's not close, but it ain't far.
Yeah.
It's the difference between being able to go out, see somebody today and come home tonight than being committed to overnight. That's right. How I describe the difference. Because you're like on a map 5 hours, but in reality, it's more like six. Because you get to the place you supposedly live, and then you drive through an hour of nothing but freaking pine trees. And not like the good kind of beautiful softwood forest pine trees, like the paper mill pine trees. Like that, when I came out there, I was like it's like all the trees and all the same age, all the same diameter, all the line. Here's where they clear cut. Here's where they replanted. You could be like, okay, next year they're going to cut that, the year after that. And I'm not putting it down, just saying like, it takes a while to freaking get there, you know, and it takes a while for you to get groceries.
Yeah.
I mean, like, it's the same kind of thing. Like,
the closest decent grocery store where we live right now is almost an hour drive. Just to get to a decent grocery store. There's, you know, worse grocery stores, you know, half an hour away. But, you know, if you want anything significant, like you want to go to we don't have Costco.
No.
Where I live.
No.
You want to go to a Sam's Club? It's an hour and a half.
And it's about right. Yeah. Yeah.
So,
When you go.
So what's nice about this place is we're going to be, you know, 5 minutes off of I-20.
Yeah.
And we're going to be, you know, a couple hours from you.
Yeah.
Still a couple hours. Yeah. Yeah. Two and a half hours.
If I drive the truck too, if I drive the Challenger.
Right.
I was being honest. I mean, you know, I bought it for a reason.
Yeah. And we're going to be closer to more amenities. So that's nice. And it should be a fantastic location and situation for hosting bigger workshops out there. So that's one of the big things that I'm excited about is I want to get this information in more people's hands. I want to be able to host more workshops on site and get people exposed to this kind of stuff, because I think as the systems of support and as, you know, the world gets more complex, it becomes easier for things like a bad flu to shut down the world's economy. And if you've got things set up to where you know, you're just not really worried about it. Like when that all went down years mm-hmm. ago, Jack.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't really know for sure what the heck was going on. And so, you know, we were set up. We could literally just stay home for 6 months. And yeah, we're going to run out of some things, but nothing we actually need. We would have been fine. So I want to see more people set up like that.
Yeah.
I want to see more people able to just like check out. If you lose your job, it's no big deal.
And this is counterintuitive, but the more people that don't give a shit if they shut down society, the less likely they are to shut down society, because now you can't threaten me with it. Because it was never shut down society. It was like, we're going to shut it down, but then you have to do it our way, and we'll give you little pieces back as you do the good boy things. Like if you put petroleum jelly on your thumb and stick it in your butt to stop the spread of COVID, we'll let you out for an extra hours a day. And half the people did it. And then people like us, we didn't give a shit. Like, I'm like, I'm going to go where I want. I'm going to do what I want. The only way I'm not going to a place is if it's closed. Mm-hmm. The first year of that we made a mistake here and increased the student headcount to 65 at the workshop here. And that was insane. And that was like, we were rocking and partying while they were saying, maybe you can have two family members over for Thanksgiving. And we have that picture that's become like the icon of workshops now, of like 85 freaking people just having a frat party in the middle of a pandemic, because we didn't care.
Right.
Because we didn't care. And because we were set up, we were able to not care. My biggest activity during the scamdemic was pissing off liberals by posting pictures of, like, I don't know, eating ribeye steak in front of my pond. Like and somehow that was going to kill their grandmother 6 states away. It was a case of what did Malone call it? Mass something psychosis.
Yeah.
Mass formation psychosis what it was. And there will be mass formation psychosis again.
Oh, yes.
It will happen. It probably won't have anything to do with COVID, right? It'll have it'll be something else they'll use to generate it. And I'd like to be in a position where I don't care. So I'm there, you're there, we're trying to help other people get there, and you're trying to get there on a new property. And I imagine that folds into something you have here called the Homegrown Liberty Foundational Class. What is that all about?
Yeah, so the foundations class, you know, I've said for years, we touched on this earlier, that I have not wanted to teach a PDC. I've had people begging me for years and years, please teach a PDC, please teach a PDC. I haven't wanted to do it because I have felt that for the average homesteader, it is not going to deliver the value that they deserve. And I don't like that. I've always felt uncomfortable with that. I don't want to use hype and an excitement about a system that has just a lot of fanboys and fangirls to make money.
Yeah.
I can do that. I don't like it. It doesn't fit with my personal ethics, you know? So, I've always wanted to develop a curriculum where I can deliver actionable information that is going to set you up for success, that is going to cut out as much of the learning curves as possible. And the first section of that is what I'm calling my foundations class. And it's going to be a lot of the same kinds of things that I go over with my clients when we go on their property. Right. So for the people that it's outside of the budget, I want to get the knowledge and the information. We're going to be recording it. Mm-hmm. I want to get that knowledge and information into people's hands. So whereas when I'm on someone's property, I'm looking at their landform, I can see, hey, these plants right here mean this gets seasonal inundation. That means we can't do certain things there. And if you don't understand what you're looking at, you're not going to know that little detail. So that's one of the big things that, that is a benefit to having me out, you know, but this foundations class, it's going to be, I mean, we are going to be talking about, access. One of the big things that, that I love doing for my clients is saving them money and the access thing. I cannot tell you how many properties I've stepped foot on and gosh dang it, if they would have just put the driveway 20 feet to one side or the other, it would have been beautiful. But they said, hey, I want my driveway here. And the operator's like, no problem, I'll put the driveway there. And they just,
just
knock it out. So I want to equip people with this foundations class with the skill set, the knowledge to say, okay, even if I'm not having someone like Nick out, I know that I need to be looking for this exact thing in my landform to get the contractor lined out properly and install things where they go. So we're going to talk about where to put in swales, should we even put in swales? Because, you know, that's one of the big things that everyone wants, a swale. Well, sometimes,
not always,
sometimes you don't. Sometimes that would be a terrible, terrible choice, but sometimes it would be a fantastic choice. And a lot of times it comes down to your goals. So, you know, just understanding what your goals are is one of those really valuable things that we can,
when it comes to things that are semi-permanent, like a swale, or truly permanent, like a pond or a driveway, but you know, all of those can be removed, but there's varying levels of how type one is that type one error.
Right.
But a lot of times what I see is people basically design out access instead of design in access. That would be like, I've seen that with swales a lot of times. Like, we want it to get all the way to the edge of the property. Oh, so there's literally no path around the edge. And when it discharges out the end, you're going to flood your neighbor's property. Right? Like, or I need a swale because I saw Jack put in swales. Do you know why Jack put in swales? No.
Right.
Then maybe you don't need a swale because you saw somebody else do it. Like, what is your ground like? What are you trying to do with it? What is your slope like? Are you in an arid or a wet climate? Like, there's like, and I what I'm hearing you try to say is you're trying to teach people to be their own consultant.
Right. So we're gonna teach you,
because they were never on 1,000 properties, but you're gonna do a client intake, whether you call it that or not, where you're gonna ask certain questions, and then you're gonna take those questions as how they're answered as to goals. Temper them against honesty, because when you say, how many hours a week are you going to work on yours? They say 15, you go 10, right? Five. See, I know, five, right? And, you know, like things like that. And then you're going to take that with the landform and the climate type, and you're going to put a heaping ass dose of reality on top of it.
Yes.
You're going to ask them a budget. They're going to give it to you. You're going to cut that in half because they don't have the money that they're going to say, because they don't want to tell you, because then you'll think that they're being cheap or whatever. And so then with all of that in mind, you'll come up with a design. And if it turns out they have another 10,000, well, here's phase two. But let's get into the reality of phase one first. And even if they have the money, like, maybe we should phase into this anyway. And so you can see if this is what you really want, because there are times where people are like, I've done things like, yeah, that sucked, I don't want that anymore. Like, quail, right? And it wasn't a big expense or anything, but it was like, Dorothy won't eat them. Okay, I'm done. It wasn't even that they were bad or hard to do. It was just, if I'm going to be the only one eating the damn thing, I'm not doing it.
Right. Yeah. So, we're going to go over how to assess your property, how to design your layout with purpose. Not just
let's use a teaching moment right now, though. See that comment? Use that comment to explain why people need a consultant, Nick, because that is, I don't mean to pick on Renee, but that is a very off point right there. That's like, so Renee said, for those that are on the audio only, swales mean nothing in the high desert of Montana. Go ahead, Nick.
Yeah. So in any of those desert type environments, you are going to get some precipitation. Even if it's high desert of Montana, you're going to get your, I mean, at the worst, you're looking at 10 inches of precipitation in a year. And depending on where it is, most likely that's going to be in snowmelt. Okay. So high desert in Montana, I bet it's mostly going to be snowmelt. You might get a couple rains. So swales, they don't mean anything in deserts. I could not disagree more.
Yeah.
If you around
how many people have you heard say they only work in deserts?
Yeah, where it's in Arizona.
Yeah.
It's near it starts with a P. It's not Prescott. It might be near Prescott, Arizona.
Okay.
Back in the 30s, I believe, the whatever that government
civilian
program,
conservation corps. I know what you're talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah.
Look, if you find them on a satellite, they look like giant worms in the desert, right?
You can see them on satellite right now.
Yes.
And it's green and it is lush and thick. And you go it. I saw a video of someone walking down into it, and they dug down into beautiful black, gorgeous dirt with worms in it in the freaking desert.
And so, I promise you, that desert is more harsh than the Montana high desert. At least in the heat portion of it. Like, it's not going to have quite the cold that Montana will, but yeah, you're going to, yeah. I mean, I'm a big student of Jeff Lawton, for those that don't just take that word and go, oh, Jeff, but not Jeff. Jeff famously said one time, and it stuck in my head, when you design a desert, you're designing to a flood. Because when you get, you only get 10 inches of rain a year, and you get one rain event of 2.5 inches, and it hasn't rained for 6 months when you get that 2.5 inches, what happens? The water just streams across the landscape, erodes
streams
everything, and the guy that put the swales in captures it and infiltrates it and builds a 6-month battery until the next rain. So the connotation that this, and I'm not really wanting to pick on Renee here, I'm just saying, like, this is where it's a lack of experience.
Right.
Because the next person's going to come in and go, I don't need swales because I get lots of rain. And then we're going to go, yeah, well, what's your landform? Are you creating a bog or a marsh where you don't want one? Could we spread that water out? Do you have lots of rain 6 months out of the year and no rain 3 months out of the year? And could we then build ponds and interconnect them with swales so we could create a water battery to get, like, and at the same time, we're going to tell the person that believes they absolutely need swales, no, you don't. Like, that's the worst idea ever. It's hard to understand because I think what people are looking for is tab A, slot B, and it'd be always that way. This is biology. This is landform. And then there's a moving part in the landowner, right? You might not want swales because you just don't want them. We can design something without them.
Sure.
But it doesn't mean they don't do anything.
Right.
They never do anything, right? If your swale doesn't do anything, you had a bad consultant and it's not a swale. Those are the two things that I know about. You made a drainage ditch. Okay. And it's still got something. It just might not be what you wanted it to do.
Yeah. Yeah. So, in that class, we're going to be, covering stuff like that. Why would we want a swale here in this part of the property? Whereas we're not putting swales in another part of the property. And why would we choose to do that? Why would we, and what ramifications would impact our decision, that decision matrix for choosing whether or not this is a good place for them or it would be a bad place for them? You know, I've got some heavy clay soils there. Well, swales in heavy clay, some people say absolutely never in heavy clay. Well, it depends.
What are you doing?
What are you doing? Do you have an amazing local network of Asian immigrants who want duck eggs?
Mm.
Like, do you have the capability of setting up, setting up a tiered system on your slope where you can rotationally graze a huge flock of ducks and make a killing off of duck eggs? Well, in that case, you might actually want to put swales on a slope, on a hillside with heavy clay. Otherwise, you probably wouldn't. So, you know, there are reasons why you might want to choose to do that when everybody else would not, just because you have one little piece of a context that changes the script. So, discussing ramifications of poor placement, show the synergy that occurs when you have all the right elements flowing into another. Those connections are some of my favorites right there. And then, of course, we're going to be walking the students through exactly how and why we are doing what we're doing for the initial development phase of the property. And, you know, part of what I'm excited about for this first foundations class is the ability to show everybody what it looks like beforehand, and so that they can see what I'm seeing and you know, get down and dirty with the initial assessment. Because if you come on the property in 5 years, it is going to be phenomenally different.
Mm-hmm.
But if you were there on day one and you saw exactly what it looked like when John Dowie, when he, you know, very, very seldom comes to a workshop, John, we always talk about, because he was at one of those, I think it was the first workshop.
We did a little Hoogle mounts, yeah.
Yes, yeah. And so we put those in, and he and I know, and we always remark about how freaking different it is. And when someone who's brand new, who's never been to a workshop, they show up and they're like, oh, this is really nice. And
they have no idea. Like,
you have no clue.
You have no idea. You're staring at a productive tree growing in 4 inches of dirt.
Oh, my gosh.
Like, literally 4 inches of dirt, and it's limestone, and that tree's alive. Like, I've had a lot of losses, but you know that, like, I shouldn't have had a lot of losses. I should have had 100%. Like, yeah. Nothing should live here. Like, I remember one time I said, this is really hardy, but it didn't make it here. You said, well, you made a mistake. And I said, what? You went, you planted it here. And I'm like, there's a spot. She goes, you go, no, here.
Here.
Here on your property. Of course.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Man. And so just being able to see the difference, see what you're starting with is going to be a stark contrast. And it's going to.
So this class, is that going to begin then next year once you're on your property? Is that how that's going to work?
So it depends on how this year goes. If this summer goes really well, I would like to do that class about this time next year.
Okay.
So late spring, early summer, I would like it to be still a comfortable time of the year. So a little bit earlier than
Don't recommend midsummer for anything in Texas other than I don't know, an ice sculpture exhibit like at a hotel. That would be a good thing to do in July in Texas.
Yeah. So I would like to time it so that I can start getting some of the fodder trees in and have some of that already done, so that the students can see, you know, some of this stuff in the ground growing, you know, some of those design elements already in place. But I want it to be a nice time of the year where you know, it might be rainy, but at least if you're camping, it's not going to be hot and sweaty and sticky. 17,000 degrees.
Throwing rings in the field to get rid of them and shit, because that happens.
Yeah. So I'm going to be aiming for next spring if this year goes well. If not, then it will be either in the winter or the following spring.
Okay. Now, I know when you say how this summer goes and how this year goes, that one of the things you're talking about is, you know, how well your consultancy picks up this year. And so you have a planned consultancy tour. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So I have plans in the works I'm basically going to be going from the East Coast, probably all the way up to the Rockies, depending on the response. If there's a bunch of people that are still on the West Coast, despite all of the encouragement to you know, walk to freedom, if there's a bunch of people still over there, then I'd be happy to go to the West Coast. But I'm knocking down my consulting rates for this summer for everyone that wants to sign up. And on top of knocking down my rates to get as many people stacked up as I possibly can, I'm also going to be including, for the people that sign up for consulting, a free class ticket. So you get to come to the class. It'll be a weekend class. And you won't have to pay a single penny. So whatever your expenses are, your food, your lodging, there's going to be hotels nearby. There's other campsites nearby if you want to bring in like RVs or whatever. But if you want a tent camp, there's going to be plenty of room on the property on itself. So yeah, for everyone that signs up for an on-site consult this year, this calendar year, you're all getting a free ticket to come to the class.
Let's say that again, because I don't know if that fully went into some brains out there. What he's saying is if you retain him for a consulting on this tour, this class that he's talking about, that's going to be probably about this time next year, maybe later. It all depends on how this goes. You get a free seat.
That's right.
Not a guaranteed seat, a free seat. But basically, it's included in the cost of your consultancy. That's pretty freaking badass.
Right. So you know, if you're crunching the numbers and you're like, hey, I definitely want to come to this class, well, man, just knock that off of the consulting price, and you're getting rates that I have not had in 6-7 years.
Yeah.
And we've had just a little bit of inflation since then.
A little bit of inflation and a lot of experience.
Right.
You're worth more than you were 5 years ago. Maybe not as a person, but as a consultant, right?
Like right,
you always
right.
value the person, but as a consultant, you're a better, if you weren't a better consultant 5 years later, I probably wouldn't have you on the air anymore.
Right.
If you're doing something every day, you should be getting better at it. Or
I've gotten a little bit better as the years have progressed. Yeah. So that's really exciting. I've already got, I've got a bunch of response before even mentioning this on the air. So, I've already got people asking about bringing me out to the West Coast. There's a couple people. We've got people up in Idaho and in Wyoming, in Montana, in the Dakotas. There's a bunch of people up near the Great Lakes, and we've got people in North Carolina and South Carolina. I mean, we've got probably a dozen or more states already represented. So,
see that guy down there in the comment? Yeah, he's about an hour north of me.
Awesome. No, price does not depend on the land. Most of the consults on this tour are going to be in between $1,400 and $2,000 for a full 8-hour day on site. A lot of it comes down to how far I'm having to drive, whether or not I'm having to grab an Airbnb, or if my clients have camping on site where, you know, I can plug in and get a fan out to my vehicle or whatever. I'm going to try and get it as close to around $1,400 a day.
Yeah. And if you have a cluster of people and you have to travel, then you can spread that travel against everybody, right? If there's an airplane ride and a rental car involved, then you can prorate that. You get four people, it's going to be a bigger chunk for travel than if you had eight.
That's right.
Relative cluster. Like that, it's not a cluster if we're both in Montana. It's a big state.
Right.
It's a big state. If you're talking corner to corner, it's a big state.
And one of the really cool things, especially with the TSP community, is this offers a very unique opportunity for regional TSP members to get together. Because what I've actually done in the past, and I don't mind doing this on this tour, there are people that, you know, you might have four people with half acre lots or whatever, that are all in the same neighborhood. and they didn't know that they were in the same neighborhood, or they might be 5 miles apart and they didn't even know that they were 5 miles apart. And yeah. I'd say, Hey, Bob, you know, there's like two other people that are just within 5-10 miles of you. Would you guys all be interested in, you know, sharing, you know, your email address with each other? And what we've done in the past is we'll go to one person's property in the morning. We'll spend 4 hours there. We'll break for lunch. We'll go to the next person's property. We'll spend 4 hours on that property. So everybody gets a half day, but the whole group goes to each property and they see different things that spark different responses and ideas and brainstorming kind of sessions in each person's head. And, oh, hey, this is a cool, cool situation you've got here. What if you did this? Or, hey, I've got this resource. And you get this networking that only normally happens at the workshops, mm-hmm. that we get to do with a regional group of people. And I think that is just premium. So I love doing stuff like that. Now, I've even had people say, you know, hey, I really want to have you out, but I can't afford the consulting rate. Is there something else we could do? And I say, yeah, I charge a flat rate for my time when I come out to teach a class. So yeah. I've had people that say, hey, I've actually kind of network as a business, and I know a lot of people that would be interested in coming to a class. I'm like, yeah. Great. I'm going to charge you a flat rate to spend all day out there. We'll walk the property. I'll teach a class on design science. You get your day of consulting.
Yep.
And
charge you pay what you me want my, for your students.
You charge what you want for your students, and maybe you actually make some money. That's actually happened on more than one occasion. So yeah, lots of you different ways we can do things.
It's a good deal, even after feeding the people. I mean, you know,
right.
You make a profit, great. You know, I think that's yeah. good. One question I always ask any consultant, doesn't care if it's permaculture, homesteading, business, whatever, what's your deliverable at the end of like an 8-hour property consultation?
Yeah, so I have different tiers of things that we can deliver. We can spend the whole time just walking and talking. We can spend half the time walking and talking, assessing the property, and then spend a couple hours sitting down, sketching stuff out. It is custom fitted to every single individual, what they want, what they desire. I have literally had people that had one question. I walk out there, I answer the question. The guy's like, dude, you saved me $10,000. That's all I needed right there. Yeah. I just wanted that one $10,000 question answered.
Yeah.
That saved me so much money. How about we just hang out for the rest of the day? We'll crack open some beers and throw some steaks on the grill, and we just spend the rest of the day hanging out and BSing. I've had other clients where it is just nonstop, go, 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 go. And they get 10 years worth of work. And at the end of it, they're just kind of looking at me deer in the headlights and just saying, I can't fit anything else in my yeah. head.
Yeah.
And I bring a Zoom recorder and I mic up. So if you would like a audio recording of the whole dang thing, super simple and easy to do. We just pull the memory card out, pop it in your laptop or your PC or whatever, transfer the files over. You've got audio recording of the whole day. If people want a follow-up, I also do as an add-on, I do a written report. So if you want a written report with all the notes, other recommendations, other observations and suggestions, products, solutions that, you know, we talked about but weren't exactly 100% sure this certain solution would work for this this situation, you know, that'll be in the written report. If you want more advanced soil testing and you want a mineral prescription for remineralizing your property or your garden or your orchard, you know, that's one of those big things that I've talked about on the show quite a few times now, is, you know, if you've got a bug out location where you're concerned, you're going to bring your grandchildren out there. If the stink hits the fan, you're taking your grandchildren out there and you're going to raise a garden, and you don't have any zinc in your soil, and you're going to be feeding your grandchildren a zinc deficient diet. I mean, that's not the best thing. So yeah. If you're really concerned about it, you know, spending a couple $100 to make sure that your soil is actually beautifully well mineralized so that those plants have everything they need to reach their
peak. This is a big thing that I've tried to get across for years. Like this idea that compost fixes everything. Well, compost can fix many things, right?
Right.
Even maybe, dare I say, most things. But you know what it can't do? It can't make zinc.
Yep.
Right? You need a fusion reaction to make higher elements. If the zinc isn't there, you can put all the unless you're composting it with zinc in it, you're not going to get zinc. Like, you're not going to make two lower elements come together and form a higher element. That's not physically possible in this universe. That's not how that works. You don't have a star in your yard. You have it overhead. And it's not helping you at this point with zinc anyway. So zinc, you know, if you're zinc deficient, you're probably also copper deficient, right? Like selenium is another one, hugely deficient in a lot of areas of the country. And you can't make selenium on your property. You have to bring it in.
Right. And you know, those are some of those things that a lot of people, I had no clue that was even a thing.
Yeah.
So, I can take soil core samples and I know how to do it. I could show you how to do it. I could give you instructions. You could do it yourself. You could send it off. You can try and figure out what to do with it, or you can just push the easy button and know that it's done perfectly. You know that it's done well, and you know that the information that you're getting is solid and you can trust it. So, we do that. I think I covered that well. I'm trying to think if there's anything else that I need to cover with the deliverables.
One of the things some people might want is some sort of a phased plan. Like,
you
lay out this brilliant vision over the next 5 years, but what typically people do is they do like 5% of this project, 5%, and it's all disarrayed, and it looks like me, right? You don't want to be me in this situation. You want to, like, here's where the chicken system's going to go. Let's build that first, and then that's going to tie into this. So we build that next. So is there a deliverable like that?
Oh, yeah. So that is 100%. That is one of my big points that I always like to hit, is a lot of times people have these grand visions and dreams, and they're like, I want to do all of the things.
Yeah.
You ask them, okay, what animals do you want? And they list off all of the things, right?
Pigs, chickens, cows, goats, sheep, monkeys. Right, monkeys up in the tree eating figs, right? Like, or whatever.
and so, you know, part of my job is to kind of reel that back and say, okay, I think all those things are great. Let's put those all on the plan, right? Let's put them on paper. But what is the thing that you need to be focusing on this year? And that's top priority. And then what is the next thing that I can see? So I put myself in your shoes with your goals, your abilities, your future in mind, your finances, you know, your time budget, as well as your financial budget. How would I accomplish the goals that we have come together as a client and consultant? How would I implement those goals with all of those factors involved to get you there as fast and efficiently as possible? And yeah, that is exactly what we go through on a consult, is how do you get there and what is the best way? Because a lot of times, it seems like getting, you know, X design element put in first is going to be the best thing. Cause a lot of people, they'll really get focused on the trees, you know, the fruit trees. I need to get those fruit trees in this year. And I say, well, hold up a second, because they'll truthfully say, you know, the best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago and the second best time is now. Well, that could be the case, but it could also be the case that if you just put that off 1 year, you could have things prepared and staged so that you don't lose all of those fruit trees because you don't have the infrastructure for them. So sometimes it's actually a lot better to slow your roll on stuff like that and phase things in a slightly different sequence than would initially seem to be the case, you know? So, I think it's important to be able to kind of have the distance from the problem that mm-hmm. someone from the outside can add to the situation.
I've always told people when you get enough education, start doing real design. The first thing you design should be something you don't own, touch, or care about. Go design the field in front of the public library. Go find some big open blank slate. You're not going to do it, right? You're not going to actually do the work. And that's going to be another level of separation where you're not going to get obsessed with it. And you're going to free your mind and you're going to be like, oh, I can put a pond right there and look at the landform and a connection swale across. And then those could all be trees. And depending on what the people I wanted to do, like it could be a fodder tree system or a stone fruit or an apple, or it could be a combination thereof. And then this form, you just see it like it just boom, boom, boom. You look at your own property. You're like that, the meme. You
know, analysis paralysis.
The stupid guy and the smart guy and the midwit in the middle. But you act like the midwit, and you feel like the retard. That's how you feel when you first try to design your own property, because you get caught up in all the what ifs and the desire and everything else, instead of coming at it from I am painting a picture in a landscape.
Right.
And I know what I want the picture to be, and this is how I take this landscape into that picture. Or this landscape will never be that exact picture, because there's the hesitation, and there's also like the attachment. Like I remember the first time I saw when Jeff did his first online PVC, and he had that one property he designed, and he had the driveway going in. He had the two oblong ponds on both sides of it, and he picked up all the road catchment into those two oblong ponds. And I was like, I want to do that. And nothing I looked at was ever right to do that. You have to let go of what you're attached to.
Right, right.
And that might be one of your jobs, is like to have the sword of detachment. Yes. Thou shalt not do this. That shall cost thou much money, and thou shalt be unhappy. So don't do it.
Yeah. You know, that's actually at that workshop, this last workshop that I was at, I think it might have been the one before, I had spoken with some potential clients that were going to be coming to the workshop. So they showed up and we looked at a bunch of different MLS listing properties that they were looking at for their retirement. Mm-hmm. And I looked through like a dozen of them, and I found one that my gut, I told him, it's like, man, my gut says this is the one. And he's like, okay, well, we'll make sure that's in the list. So fast forward like a month later, and I'm coming out there. We're going to be touring properties for 2 days. Okay.
Yeah.
So 2 day consult. We're touring the properties, and we go through like four of the properties. And I was like, "Hey, bud, where's that one that I pointed out?" And he's like, "Oh, it's in the list here somewhere." And he's flipping through the list, and he goes through like 20 something properties, and I think it was one of the last two pieces of paper. And I was like, we got 2 days. We're not going through these fast enough. Let's move that at least to, you know, early tomorrow.
Yeah.
Because I have a feeling about that property. And we're going through looking at some of them. And he loved this one property. Okay. And I just knew, you know, their retirement age. And I'm thinking, okay, if I was purchasing property, retirement age, and I know I'm going to have declining physical capabilities,
mm-hmm.
I don't want steep property. Mm-mm. And Jack, 80% of this acreage was behind a deep ravine, and it was steep.
Okay.
And so it's like, dude, you're purchasing a whole bunch of land potentially that you're never going to touch.
Yeah.
And so So I said, oh, I think this is nice, but let's just keep looking. And I was able to convince them to go look at that one piece of property that I knew a month prior was the one.
Yeah.
I tell you what, we walked 20 feet onto the property and they're both kind of cutting their eyes over and looking at each other like, oh man, this is it. And they're looking around at the beautiful oaks, a gorgeous little piece of property. It is small enough to be manageable. It's yep. flat enough to be easily traversable with something as simple as a golf cart.
Yep.
I saved them six figures in their working budget.
Yeah.
Just yeah. like that.
Yeah, because you don't need this. And, nope. you know, age is a factor that we don't like to accept as we get older, Mr. Graybeard here. But it's a reality. You know, I don't really want 80 acres to manage. Now, if I had 79 acres of forests with trails that I can drive an ATV on and 1 acre to manage, then I'm all in on 80 acres. But you have to start thinking that way. Like, I'm a big fan of the concept of the Greek proverb that a society grows great when old men plant trees they know they will never sit in the shade of. I think that's great, and you should do that. But if you're old, like me, and you want to sit in the shade of some trees, you might want a property that already has a few.
Right.
That's all I'm saying, that you might want a more mature, smaller property if you're older when you're making this move, instead of, you know, here's a 20-acre farm that's basically a giant field that's been plowed, and it's going to need 5 years of rehab before it can be even begin to see its potential. That's a right. project for a 30-year-old.
Right.
And that's not ageist or whatever. That's just freaking reality. That's temporal reality right there.
It is. So yeah, on the consulting thing, I cannot even list. It's been pretty much every single property that it's a new purchase.
Yeah.
If you have just purchased property and you can at all fit it in your budget before you start putting in infrastructure, please get someone like me out. I don't care if you don't even hire me.
I understand.
Get somebody, because every single freaking time I walk on a piece of property and they have just purchased it, they're putting in a driveway. They yeah. have not picked where they're going to put their house, where they're going to put the driveway, where they're going to put the barn.
You know,
without
I just
fail.
A great marketing angle for you. You don't want to be on a reality show, right? You notice there's no reality shows yeah. about here's how to set up your homestead. There's reality shows about you've completely fucked up your homestead and this dude's going to come in and fix it, right?
Yeah.
That is not what you don't. They don't make reality shows about doing things the right way because there's no drama in them.
Yeah.
So if you don't want drama, you want smart design from the beginning, because I don't do this because I don't want to. I don't like to consult, but occasionally I will go look at a property for somebody. And I know you've seen this way more than me. You walk and you go, man, if I was only here 2 years ago.
Yep.
If I was only here two, if you only asked me before you did this, like, because what I have to tell you now is, so what you need to do, the excavator you did this with, go get it.
Yeah.
Put it back the way that it was, right? You know, and like, can we salvage it? Yeah, but honestly, the path to fixing it is much quicker. This, like, it's like when somebody says you want to rebuild this house and you look at the house and go, yeah, no, what this house needs is a match, right? Yep, this yep. needs a match and 5 gallons of gasoline. And you, like, it will cost you way less now to rebuild the house because the house wasn't maintained. Yep. And it's not the same, but it's a good analogy, I think.
Yeah, there's a lot of properties where they have me out after they've put in their driveway and their house and they put in a pond and now they want to get things kind of lined out better. Yeah. And I'm just like, oh, and half of the time if it's something, it's like it's just going to make you feel bad. If I tell you, I'll just keep yeah. my mouth shut about it, but it's
can't
like,
fix it.
Damn. Yeah. I could have saved you 50 grand.
Can you maybe talk some more? Like, you talked about how you save people money as a pre-property purchase mm-hmm. consultant. I think that's a great angle. But there may be just some other things, like you go out, you talk to a guy, he wants to do a thing, you're like, don't do that, do this.
Yes.
And right there, that's 5 or 10 grand that they didn't yes. lose.
Yes. Okay, so I just had a friend out in Georgia. He's like, man, I want sheep. This is what I want to be doing, blah, blah, blah. And He's like, I already got fence posts for this one portion and fence. And I was like, oh,
okay.
What kind of fence did you get? What kind of fence posts? And, you know, give me a ballpark what you already spent on it. Dang it, man. Like, I've got fencing solutions for people that are as cheap as running barbed wire.
Hmm.
That you will have far less maintenance on, and you can contain your livestock far easier and far better. So that it's just like, you can put in a Cadillac $100,000 fence system. That's fine. I don't have a problem with that. But why put in a $100,000 fence system when you can put in a $20,000 fence system that's going to work better? Or it's going to work perfectly fine for your needs, and you just don't need to spend all that money. Spend all that money on something else. Fencing. Fencing is one of those big ones. I've actually spoken with clients where this was an applicable thing. Something as simple as, you know, he's not a 6'3" guy. He's a smaller dude. And he's talking about spending $40,000 on a UTV so he can get around the property and do stuff on the property. I'm like, dude, why would you spend $40,000 on a UTV?
I don't understand.
Well, I need something that's kind of like a Jeep, like four-wheel drive or all-wheel drive, and I need to be able to haul stuff, so it needs to have a little pickup truck bed kind of thing. You know, the pickup truck beds and those are like this big.
Tiny.
And it's open cab, and you're going to be eating dust and getting bitten by mosquitoes, and you're going to get rained on, and it's going to be really cold in the winter and all this stuff. And then have you ever had one of those things get repaired?
It's, you know, I've never seen one of them do not break.
Right?
They break a lot.
So, like, I ask him, have you ever heard of these little Japanese pickup trucks that you can get for like $5,000? They're all wheel drive. They've got heat and air conditioning. They've got the truck beds have fold down sides.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's an enclosed cab. It's all wheel drive. They freaking go anywhere.
Yeah.
They're almost better, if not better, on every single aspect than one of those $40,000 ATVs.
Yeah.
And so you want to spend $40,000? Okay. Buy two of them, buy three of them. So you have parts.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then like you can pimp it out with some cool stuff. You can put modular toolboxes on the dang things. Yeah.
Just get an Isuzu.
Yeah, there's Isuzus. They make Hondas they're fantastic power plants and drivetrains.
If someone does want open cab for whatever dumb reason they do, you know, a cutting torch is pretty cheap compared to a UTV. And
right?
Now you have a torch and a truck with the roof cut off of it. I mean,
right?
I knew a guy, he sold the place, but he used to run one of the hog hunting operations down south of here. And he did this way back when they were stupid cheap, those old Bronco 2s. Mm-hmm. He got a bunch of them, and he just cut the roofs off of them.
Yeah.
And they were perfect for taking his hunters out to stands and stuff like that. And a big enough, you know, back area to throw a pig in when they shot one. And, like, I couldn't see him running that operation with, like, a fleet of Polarises. You get down to, like, those things now, like, even, like, the cheap ones are $14,000, $15,000. I choke on the thought of buying something I can't drive on the road that costs me that much money.
Yeah,
it just doesn't work for me. I can't even conceive of something. I don't get it.
Yeah, it just doesn't make financial sense in a lot of situations. And it's stuff like that where people are talking about, I have this problem and I need a solution to it. And this is the solution I came up with. And it's going to cost me $20,000.
Yeah.
And just because, you know, someone like me has been on hundreds of properties, I've seen so much ingenuity, so much, like, I don't take credit for figuring all this stuff out. Not at all. I've seen so much brilliant solutions. I'm just an amalgamator. I'm not all that.
Also not emotionally attached to the idea.
Right.
That's a big thing. And people don't know when you're attached to an idea emotionally.
Yeah.
Because your mind will do everything to convince you that you're not.
Yeah.
And having that outside source sometimes is like, and as soon as somebody says it, you're like, yeah, that was dumb.
Yeah.
Well, I'd rather realize it was dumb before I spent the money than after. Right.
Like right.
The refund policy is not very good on a SUV or many of these things that are, you know, a UTV and you bought it 6 months ago. They're not taking it back
right.
while you're still making payments on it, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah. And another one of those things is access. Even if you already have your house and your main, you know, zone one situated, right? And you're going to be expanding out and putting in even just some farm tracks, just knowing where to put those so that you're going to have less maintenance it might not save you tens of thousands of dollars. It might save you hundreds or thousands of dollars. It'd certainly pay for my day on site easily, but the more concerning thing to me is when I see people choosing avenues of development on their property that I know this is going to cost you at least 20, if not 40 hours a year, just because you chose to put it right here versus 20 feet to the right.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and it's like, man, if I can save you 20 hours here and 20 hours there, and I can end up saving you a couple hundred hours of labor a year for the rest of the time you're there.
Yeah, for the rest of your life.
For the rest of your life. That is a significant thing.
Yeah.
And the older I get and the more I interact with more wealthy clientele, the more I can see these guys, they're like, man, time is money. I don't care what this costs. If it's going to save me, you know, 30 hours a year, I'm going to throw money at that to save myself the time for the rest of my life because it pays back, you know, like logarithmic scale, exponential scale, really.
So this Texas project you're going to be embarking on, you've called it a clean canvas that's 100% NIC. What makes this land so exciting for you? Because now let's talk about you developing your own land here a bit.
Oh, yeah. So you've gone through the same kinds of things I've done where you have a good idea and you're like, man, I'm excited about quail, for instance, or ducks. And you're going to put in the thing and then you get it in there and you realize, you know, this just doesn't mesh with my life. This is not the kind of thing that I want to be dealing with every day. Like you had the ducks. I love the ducks at your place. I got ducks. I hate the ducks at my place with a freaking passion. I despise the ducks.
Well, your ducks, for some reason, they all like went to your bedroom window every morning and screamed into your house, right?
Gosh.
Like, their goal, the landform just worked out that way. This is where we're going to hang out and quack at Nick in the morning.
Yeah. So I have Muscovies, and we adore our Muscovies.
Okay.
They're fantastic. But like, I got ducks and then found out I hate ducks. So, The big thing is I'm going to get to take my kind of cobbled together chicken barn and the mulch yard and all of those systems that I was able to develop over the last, you know, couple decades. I'm going to be able to recreate that from scratch, from the get-go, beautifully, and show how these things all mesh together and rotate one product, one outflow into the next, and how it can all recycle together and mesh perfectly. I get to demonstrate like the fruit trees and the nut trees coupled with grazing systems. The fencing system that I like, mm-hmm. that I've found to be really, really efficient and useful. I get to get all that stuff, you know, straight from nothing, where the plan for the perimeter fencing is I want to get hedgerows, like proper laid hedgerows put in. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be having an offset with our new fencing that we're putting in. And then once the hedgerows are all in and mature and grown in, then we'll have, we'll be able to remove fencing and repurpose it for other things.
Like
and
now we have
like cross fencing.
Yep.
So yeah, that's, I know I'm going to make mistakes. I know I'm going to do things that later is, you know, we're going to say, you know, we need to change that out for something else. But the big thing that I'm really excited about is being able to demonstrate and show the whole TSP community and further what is possible if you get into this with a really good knowledge base and you know what you're doing and you lay things out intelligently, what it can actually become. So, man, that's really exciting. And of course we've got the nursery expansion. And that's really, really going to be a lot of fun. I've got my youngest son who is really growing into that. He loves plants. So he might be my little buddy with the plant propagation. So yeah, exciting stuff.
Yeah. You talk a lot about fodder trees and we're getting some conversation about that in a roundabout way right now. Can you talk about, I think when you say fodder trees, people think, well, that's great for like 10 years from now, but you can actually get fodder production really, really quick with the right trees.
Right. Yeah. So, they stand up to grazing, don't they? Generally speaking, if you're growing these trees for fodder, they either need to be pollarded, which is above, all of the leaves are above browsing height, or they need to be coppiced and in a livestock excluded system. You don't want them getting in there and stripping all the leaves off of them. You want to be harvesting the leaves like, here's a good analogy. You have pastures and then you have hay fields. You generally do not want to be running livestock in your hay field if it's for growing hay, right? Because if it's at all wet, the cows are going to get in there and they're going to push down the mud and they're going to pug up your soils and you're going to not be able to cut hay very efficiently, right? So if you think about these trees like giant grass plants, I mean, they're big plants, but they're going to grow way faster than grass, produce way, way higher protein content than grass. Grass is normally single digits. I mean, you're lucky if your grass gets to 12% protein, which is, which is like not even enough for your livestock to really thrive. Most livestock you're wanting to be shooting for at least 12, if not 16% protein.
Okay. Yep.
So for the vast majority of the year, your grasses are going to be below 12% protein. Well, for the vast majority of the year, white mulberry, for instance, is going to be above 20% protein. That is a massive, massive difference.
Yep.
So if you're able to grow some of your protein supplementation for your livestock, and this could be stock from quail on up to, you know, full size cattle. And you're able to do that on site. You're able to remineralize the area that you're harvesting your fodder leaves from. You're going to have healthier trees for one. And then it's like you're going to be focusing your remineralization efforts on those fodder trees and then allowing the manure drop to spread those minerals out in a colloidal form to the rest of your property. So it's bound up with the humic acids and the other components in the animal's manure. So it's not actually rinsing out immediately like it would be if you were just putting out a powder on your ground in your pasture, for instance. So yeah, fodder trees, I think they are, they're one of the foundational things that we all need to be including on our properties if we want to get as self-sufficient as possible. I mean, if you're wanting to raise poultry, just quail, for instance, well, I can raise the mulberry leaves and feed them to black soldier fly harvest larva. Mm-hmm. And I can harvest that stuff and feed it directly to the quail. And they'll peck at it. They're not herbivores, so they're not going to eat a ton of it. But like 10% of their diet could very easily be white mulberry. It's high protein. They're going to do really well on it. It's highly digestible. So that is my number one pick. I see a lot of locust stuff popping up in the chat.
I think it's more question than statement.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, questions about the locusts. I think they're fantastic trees. You know, Elon Musk has got his flamethrower thing. I think flamethrowers are fantastic. Some people don't need to be playing with them though.
Yes.
Because you're gonna get burned. And so
you should have seen the flamethrower that Eric Myers had at Nicole's.
Oh, did he have a different one?
A whole other level, dude. I'm talking like, and then when it hits, when you're done, there's still flames. Like World War II looking freaking trench clearing flamethrower. But you're right. Not everybody should have one of those. And probably Eric Myers is one of the people that shouldn't have one of those. But here we are. He has them.
I'm glad Eric has flamethrowers. That makes me very happy. Locust trees. For what you actually get out of them, I think in most situations, they are not a wise choice. If you don't have them on your property, I do not think it is wise to bring them on your property unless you really know what you're doing. And if you don't have them on your property, I would really question if you've really dealt with them. And if you haven't dealt with them, I can guarantee you don't know what you're doing with them. So a lot of the things that people will throw out there, again, kind of speaking to the permaculture crowd, which I think is a fantastic design science, but I think there's a lot of people that just kind of, they hear something and it's like copy and paste from a blog I read that they're fantastic and so everyone should have them. Mm-hmm. Well, bro, yes, they have fantastic BTU for you know, fuel wood or firewood. Mm-hmm. The black locust sapwood is only, I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head, so I might be over or undershooting this. I think the sapwood was like 10% higher, might have been 20-25% higher at the top end, but I think it was around 10% higher BTUs than white mulberry.
Yep.
So why the hell would I bring in something that literally makes branches that drop from the tree, it will drop them, that are natural caltrops that will go straight through my boots. They have thorns that do this. If it's laying here, well, one's still pointing up. It's freaking caltrops. They'll do that to your livestock guardian dogs, your sheep, your goats. They will make an animal lame. And then the seed pods will kill some animals. So it's like, I'd rather
hear going, doesn't Jack have black locust on his property? Yes. Yeah. Jack knows how to manage black locust, grew up with black locust, and has a property where trees naturally spreading just doesn't happen at the level it does somewhere else. So I'm completely happy with my choice to plant black locust.
Right.
I am not happy with my choice to plant even grafted jujubes.
Yeah.
Because they sucker. And jujube causes me the misery that locust would cause a lot of other people, right? Yep. So, like, the jujube eventually is going to meet an excavator. I'm just going to say that. That's going to happen because I'm not going to deal with this. 10 years from now, when I'm, you know, in my mid-late 60s, I don't want to still be dealing with it.
Right. And so, you know, Jack has black locusts on his property. We planted them. I helped plant them.
Yep.
In some situations, they can be very powerful, very, very good tools, but it's like a firearm in the hands of someone who doesn't know how to handle a firearm. It can be dangerous. So until you actually know that you need it and you know what to do with it and you get a little bit of training, then I would say just stay away from it if you're just hearing about how great they are from the permaculture crowd, for instance.
Yeah, and like Snail Creek is saying right here, honey bad, black locust not as bad, to a degree. Right. But like you got to know certain things. Like there is this tree, and I have several of them here, called a thornless honey locust. They're wonderful. If you have a management protocol that makes sure that they're not going to propagate, because about 1 in 10 of the propagated babies will have thorns. And you know the ones that will survive will be the ones that have thorns. And if you think black locust thorns suck, honey locusts have thorns that have thorns, and inside the thorn is another thorn. And as fast as they're big, the baby honey locusts are like freaking needles. Yep. Like those things suck. And then when you cut them all down and they all coppice back, it's a wall of needles. You don't want that, right? Like, and I'm not saying honey locust is bad. I'm saying in the wrong design, it's a terrible idea. And most of the time it's put into a design, it's a terrible idea. And it's not that, like, this is not an elitist attitude. You know, there's a town in Australia where they want to literally dig up the corpse of Bill Mollison and kill him again and put him back on the ground because he recommended honey locust, and they put in thornless honey locust.
Thornless honey
locust. What I just said happened. And in Australia, everything's invasive. Like a fart is invasive in Australia. And this whole town is like raked with all these thorns now. Now, if you live in Australia, you're bitching about thorns. I have to question your sanity because pretty much, you know, everything has a thorn here. Like, right. I'm not even that worried about thorns here because everything already had thorns. I remember when Josiah, my intern, was here. He's like, everything here wants to bite me, sting me, or stab me, right? It is a rough environment. We have oak trees that basically have thorns here, which is, that's not a thing anywhere else in the world. But still, I would tell most people around me, no, you don't want these trees that I have.
Yeah.
You just don't, you know?
Yeah.
If you're a mile down the road and your dirt's this deep, you're going to have a different propagation level of those trees. Like, I knew they wouldn't go that far here. Like, when people say, well, that's going to spread, God bless anything that will spread here.
Right, yeah.
They just, like, spread away, baby. Whatever it is, we'll take the organic matter. But
yeah, all of this stuff is so situationally dependent, and that's why I'm a real fan of that, you know, 80-20 rule. If we can get 80% of the way there with you know, productivity – by picking something that's not going to make your life a living hell for the rest of the time it's there.
Yeah.
I'm going to pick the easier to deal with thing because life is tough enough without making your life worse.
You know, and today, after being here and observing this property for more than a decade, if I was starting over, I probably wouldn't even put black locusts in, even though they work fine for me. Mm-hmm. The pioneering tree that does the best here all by itself is hackberry.
Hackberry, yeah.
And since I can now observe what's going on with hackberry here, that I didn't plant any of it, and I have hackberry now that are, you know, this big that I didn't plant, that weren't here when I got here, right? So in less than 10 years, you got a tree that's freaking 45 foot tall that grew itself. I would use a lot of hackberry in this design. And when somebody hires you as a consultant, they're getting that kind of experience where we've had that time to observe. Because most people trying to do this today, let's be honest, what's happened to them, maybe they, even like you or I, like they had it in their childhood, but like me, they drifted away from it, and now they're coming back to it. And, you know, especially if you transplanted, guys, you are not going to have these. When I first set up a garden in Texas, I grew up gardening in Pennsylvania. I did all the shit that I did in Pennsylvania. You know what? Like 10% of it worked. 10%. I grew up in a place where you could take a tomato and throw it in the yard, and if nobody mowed that spot, you know, 8 weeks later, there's tomatoes there. You could pick them. That doesn't happen here. It does eventually, but you have to do things to make it happen. Like, so if you've moved from where you learned your initial foundation, and then we've learned, as when I say we, I don't mean you and me. I mean, as a community, as agronomists, as permaculturists, as regenerative agriculturists, we've learned so much in the last 5 years. Like, and I don't even mean from experience. I mean, if the industry as a whole has learned so the advancements made in the last 5 years are probably bigger than the advancements made in the previous 20.
Yeah.
And that's why you want somebody that, like, that's your job, to stay in tune with all of this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Two of my go-tos, especially in more dryland climates, when it comes to what can we put in place of something like a black locust?
Yeah.
Two of my go-tos, Celtis occidentalis, hackberry, and and lace bark elm.
Lace bark elm's a great tree here too. Yep. Beautiful tree.
Because they're gorgeous trees. The bees go nuts over them. They make really good fodder. The seeds, chickens love the seeds. Those little little, I can't remember the name for them. They're actually used in Indian cuisine.
Yeah.
They'll pick them green and use them. There's human food, there's livestock food, there's insect food, all with that. They handle drought conditions, they handle really alkaline soils.
Yes, they do.
So it's just like,
it's all alkaline. This is all this alkaline world right here. Like, I laugh when people say, you put a cinder block in your garden pond? Isn't it going to make it alkaline? The dog's alkaline, the water's alkaline, the roof is alkaline, the air is alkaline, the tree's alkaline, I'm alkaline. It's all alkaline. That's just the way it is. And you can amend it with sulfur. Good luck.
Right.
Good luck. A garden bed that's a raised bed that's in its own soil profile, yeah, you can do that. You think you could change this property to acidic, Nick, with sulfur?
No.
With sulfur. I mean, over time, it can be done. I'll be dead by then, but it could be done. But with sulfur, you'll change it for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
You'll change it for 5 minutes. It's not going to stick.
You'd have to build up like 4 feet of organic matter, and that's going to take a little while.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to take a while, a long while. Unless, you know, if I ended up with enough money and got old man crazy enough, there could be like this fleet of dump trucks coming in. But that's probably not a good use of resources either. Let's kind of talk a little bit more. You are shifting a bit from your nursery stuff as far as your main income source over to more education. How does that all fit together? And that doesn't mean you're going to stop doing nursery stuff, does it?
No. We are actually shifting more towards the nursery and the education and more away from consulting. So the older I get, the more involved in my son's lives I get as they're maturing and growing. You know, my oldest is a 14-year-old. Mm-hmm. I need to be really involved in all of their lives. I'm wanting to shift more away from traveling and staying on site and doing the nursery stuff, hosting on site classes, and I really love growing plants, and that is actually something that's way more scalable for me. So you know, one of my big issues with consulting as my main gig, which has been for a decade ish, I can't remember how long it's been. Is I can't scale that. If something happens to my voice, or I get sick or whatever, I can't bring in income. If something were to happen to me and I have a nice, comfortable income from a plant nursery that I'm selling edible plants. I'm selling, you know, fodder trees. I'm selling, you know, aquarium plants. And rare house plants, right?
Yeah.
I'm selling all that stuff. That's almost infinitely scalable. And that is something that doesn't require me, my face. If something happens to me, a gravel truck, you know, you've talked about on your show, you know, if times get tough, even if they don't, right? We're not promised tomorrow.
Gravel truck's about as tough as shit gets right there. That's not good.
Right. And and if something like that happens and I've got a nice, good income from the nursery going, my sons are well versed in how to run it, and Katie is rocking it with the nursery. If I need to, I could always just sell that business. But you know, if something happened to me, that would be something that if I got sick or I got disabled.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Which would be even worse if I was just a burden on my family. That is something that would not require my daily input necessarily. So,
well, it's something you can systemize to the point that you can hire people.
Right.
Right. You can't hire people to do what you do as a consultant.
Right.
right? Anybody good enough to do it doesn't want to work for you.
That's right.
Right? You know? Yeah.
They're doing it themselves.
I used to tell people that all the time. Is that when I was in the marketing space and we were trying to build out a company doing mostly like SEO and web marketing, like, well, what is your biggest block into scaling the company? Like, train people. They get really good. They figure out, I can go make 150 grand a year for myself, from my house, with no clients. I don't want to do this anymore. And they leave. Like, by the time they're good enough to put in front of a client, they don't want to do it for a client anymore. I don't blame them. I left too. It was my company. it's like, why would I keep doing this for other people when I could be doing it for myself?
Right.
And, you know, so if you're a consultant, you are doing it for other people, but you're doing it as a one-man show. It's a single person's job, right? Somebody that loves to travel, whatever, you know, like that's what it's really great for. I understand what you're saying, because like my oldest grandchild is now the age of your oldest son. And I'm watching, like, we have him here 3 days a week, and I'm watching him leave for a weekend and come back, and I'm like, shit, he's taller. Right. Like, you don't want to be gone during those years. You really don't. And I was on the road a lot back then with my son when he was in that age bracket. If people want to book a consult, sign up for this class, see what you have available for nursery, any of that stuff, what do they do?
Yeah. So, homegrownliberty.com is where you can learn about consulting. So just homegrownliberty.com/consulting. There's examples there of what a typical consult looks like. Pricing, there are testimonials from previous clients that have, you know, emailed me a week or two after and said, Nick, we're still, our heads are spinning from all of this stuff. I can't believe, like, we're re-listening to the audio and holy crap, we missed so many things. And I didn't even realize that you touched on this, and I was wondering about it, and I re-listened to the audio, and oh my gosh, you told me the answer when I was right there, but I was just so overwhelmed with all of the stuff, I couldn't fit it all in my head. So I've got testimonials from clients on there. You know, we break down what the typical day looks like. All of the different deliverables, you know, I have it kind of customizable a la carte. If you want extra help, if you want, you know, I can't remember who did it. Someone at one of these workshops I think it was John Dowie started the pocket Nick joke.
Yeah.
You know, I need Nick in my pocket so I could just pull Nick out and like, hey, what is this plant or what do I do in this situation? You know, I've got clients every year that say, hey, I want you, you know, at the drop of a hat, I want you to be able to pick up the phone when I've got a question. So having a retainer set up, I'm happy to do that so that if you have a question, you want to get an answer on, hey, what's going on with this duck or this goat? This something's weird. I don't know what to do here. You know, I might not be able to tell you exactly, but I'll be able to tell you, hey, that's not a big deal. You can do this or this or this. And then, or I might be able to tell you, hey, that's a really big deal. That animal's going to be dying in the next couple of days. You need to get a vet involved because I can't really do anything for you. So, that's all on Homegrown Liberty. And then if you are interested in the plants every year on rareplantstore.com, we have our plant sale normally starts around the first of the year, January. So we've got, this year we had a whole bunch of different fruiting things, blackberries and blueberries and raspberries, fodder trees, of course. We're pretty much sold out for this year. I think we might have just a couple things. I might actually be completely sold out for the year. But as things progress, as we get onto this new land, I'm able to expand out and get a little bit more growing space. We will be expanding our offerings and getting a lot more cool stuff. I've got some really cool things. I've got some of the Hicks Everbearing Mulberry grafted right now waiting to see how those take off. And then this year we're playing around with tissue culture, so micropropagation. And that's really exciting. I can get a lot done with that. And that is very, very scalable. So that's one of the biggest things that I'm excited about this year from the nursery side of things. So yeah, for consulting, it's homegrownliberty.com. And then for the plants, it's rareplantstore.com.
Okay, we've covered a lot of ground. So let's lightning round, quick answer this stuff. I know you Sweet. Like to get into details, but I've got like 8 questions and I'm going to cut it off there because we're at 1:45. Sweet. But let's go ahead and hit these questions at least high level. Question, can we not have elements of a homestead almost anywhere we live? What's stopping me from doing it where I'm at? Probably you.
Yeah, it's probably just your mindset. Yeah. I noticed somebody said something about, you know, a third of an acre, you know, urban lot or something.
Yeah.
I've got clients from anywhere from, you know, a tenth of an acre urban lot to, you know, 10,000 acres, big corporate gigs. You can absolutely have elements of a homestead pretty much anywhere you live. There is something every single person can do when it comes to getting a little bit more resiliency built into your life. So, yes, you can absolutely do that.
Yeah. I would actually say there's some pretty big advantages for a lot of people to be on smaller property anyway. You get on big property, you get I want all the things syndrome, right?
Yep.
When you are on a small property, you have to make everything you do matter. You don't feel like, oh, I just put this there. And so you don't get this disconnected, disjoint design. And the best soils I've ever seen are small holdings intensively managed. You know, I'm not necessarily a huge fan of like square foot gardening as a thing in of itself. But what Mel did with that and the concept of managing soil by the square foot, like when you put in a 400 square foot garden, it is reasonable to take that approach. When we were talking about the statement that soils don't work in the high desert of Montana, so how much land are you talking about? She said mulch works better. If you're talking about mulching a couple hundred square foot or even an acre, it probably does. But if you're trying to restore the watershed on 50 acres, you ain't going to mulch 50 acres.
Yeah.
Right. And if you're mulching, I want to know where you're getting your mulch that affordably because I want some. Right.
Like, right.
You know, right. Like, so like that small holding has a tremendous advantage in many ways. And yes, you can, you know, the only thing I'll say is like, we'll talk about what you can do on like a apartment patio or something like that, because people want to do something and you got to work with what you have. You're not going to homestead in that situation though. There's a practical limit to you need at least something to work with. You know, you can grow some hydroponic stuff or maybe even a little kitchen garden out there, whatever. You're not going to have that homestead cycle running in that small of an environment. But if you've got the typical suburban lot, you can do something with it, right?
Yeah, even there's a lot you can do.
Yeah. Let's keep going quick, though. Dan, the delivery man, I have 1.4 acres drains back from right corner to front left corner. If looking out the back door, I can't install large swales. Are micro swales filled with wood chips a good idea? It's a maybe.
They could be. There's a lot of details. I don't know. Micro
he
swales filled
me, with. I know who this is. He buys eggs from us.
Okay.
So he's in Blackland Prairie Soils, probably a subdivision.
Yeah. So it really boils down to what are your overarching goals? What are you trying to accomplish? If you are just trying to capture and utilize the moisture, then basically what you're talking about is making bioswales where you're going to be just soaking in that water into the wood chips. So if it's really high clay content, then, you might actually end up with a little bit of an issue of, overcharging your soils with water.
Yeah.
So that could be a problem. I don't know because I don't know exactly what you're dealing with, but that could absolutely be a brilliant solution to a smaller land holding, like 1.5-ish acres.
And that could be more less than a microswale, more of a landform development, like something you could still mow, but you right. would always want to mow it in the direction of the landform you created. So you're, what I'm talking is a very low rolling. So you're just kind of like the little ones in between my two shops.
Yes.
Kind of something yes. more like that, but without the trees planted in the way mine is completely filled that space in.
Right.
Yeah, something like that. Something like it's almost like you put in a you dug out an area to put a 3-foot sidewalk in, and you put the dirt on the downhill side, but the berm is 4 foot.
Yeah.
Like that so that you have this nice like once the grass comes back after doing it, you almost don't see it unless you know to look for it. That's what I'm talking about. And that might work, but I don't see to me when you start talking about putting swales in and you get down to a land size and I'm like, but you could 100% irrigate that. Then maybe that's what you should do. I'm not saying you should, right. but maybe you should at least consider that first. All right, we'll keep going because yeah. we're not lightning rounding this at all, but that's, that's who both of us are. Hope you're offering tours. So I that wasn't really a question, but Bruce is saying, I think the whole point of what Nick is building is to have an on-site educational facility and sort of a retreat too, probably.
Yes. 100%.
Houston, question, are you doing any festivals or homestead shows? I guess that means are you going to be appearing anywhere?
I don't have anything on the docket for this year. I already did one earlier this spring for a ministry up in Oklahoma, Missouri area. So I already spoke up there this year. Of course, I'll be at Jack's. But no, I don't have anything on the docket. I'm trying to leave my summer as open for consulting and as unencumbered as I possibly can so that I can fit in as many site visits as possible this year. So the next thing is Jack's Workshop.
Jack's Workshop, which will be at Camp Carter, YMCA camp this year, and be a much larger event than it has been, with room for everybody. That'll be crazy enough. And bring your fishing poles and your tents for camping, because you'll actually be able to put stakes in the ground. That'll be a different experience. Is there a minimum size acreage that justifies the consultation? That's a different question than, you know, homestead, but I'd say, like, if you're going to put money into it, it's probably worth a consultation.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say if you're going to be spending more than $1,000 on improving your backyard and you want to be progressing towards self-sufficiency in any capacity, in any way, shape or form, then I will probably save you at least triple, quadruple what you're gonna pay me, just probably in your first year or two of things that you're gonna be spending money on. And and for the smaller the space, the less the dollar amount tends to be, and the more the time impact it tends to create. So the savings.
Plus, what's the value of the output?
Plus the output.
Yeah, what's the output? What does the productivity look like?
Right.
You know, there's a difference between putting your garden in and getting 5 of the most expensive tomatoes you've ever eaten in your life from your garden that didn't be productive, and then or having so much that you start feeding tomatoes to chickens.
Right.
There's a big difference in those two outcomes. Like that's a huge part of it. Chuck Norris Gun Club, nice handle. What do you guys think of mulberry trees for a windbreak?
I think they're great as long as they are not close to where you're planning on parking your white Lexus.
Yeah. Or your neighbor's white Lexus gets parked.
Right. Yeah, because the mulberry trees, I don't care what kind they are, unless they are a specific cultivar that only makes white berries.
Yeah.
Which are a thing. The white mulberries do not typically make white berries. They make black berries.
Yeah.
And everything that likes to eat fruit likes to eat them. And
then poop.
And then, yep. And then you've got purple bird crap all over the place. So, mulberry trees are fantastic for windbreak. They're deciduous. For a true windbreak, I like to incorporate evergreens and deciduous trees. I would put mulberry trees kind of a little bit on the lower end in value for windbreaks, I would actually put lacebark elms a lot higher just because of their structure, their branch form, their resiliency to higher winds. And they handle that stuff a lot better. So if I was picking one type of tree for the majority of the USA to be a good windbreak tree, I'd pick lacebark elm over a mulberry.
Yeah, and they're just – mulberries are really hardy. They're one of the other trees that self-propagate here. But lacebark is – I mean, there's a reason that around here, and this is not just my property, the whole area is a harsh summer environment. They're one of the main landscaping trees that you see in parking lots and things like that because they're beautiful and they, you know, they can live in a hole cut in a freaking parking lot at a Target, right? Yep. When something lives like that, you know it's got some resiliency or it wouldn't survive that.
Well, and then that
it's
really
planted on freaking fill, right? Like it's they added some landscaping dirt, which was some garbage dirt, and it's still underneath it. It's freaking road base.
And it really speaks to one of the big strengths that I love about lacebark elm is their root structure. They do not do a tremendous amount of heaving of concrete and other structures. So they're a lot That's safer a good to point. Plant close to buildings, foundations, sidewalks.
Roads,
all that stuff.
Yeah, I didn't think of that. That's a very good – and that's a big part of why they're selected for that. That and then they're not really a tree, but they're a hell of a pollinator thing. Vitex, they plant the shit out of those and those things too. They look like a crepe myrtle with purple flowers. Is the best way I can describe it. If you've never seen one, I know you know what they are. I'm saying that for other people. Houston says, do elderberries have any fodder properties?
No, actually, the leaves have a lot of toxicity issues for herbivores. So I would not be using elderberry as fodder. You can include it. In a small portion of the diet of like goats. I know, for instance, my goats will eat it, but they're not a big fan of it. And I would not make it a large component of anything.
Yeah. Elderberry is a medicinal is mainly what you're looking at there. It also makes a hell of a mead.
Yes. The flowers.
The flowers are good too for a mead. Yeah. But, the elderberries themselves, in a, like a Melomel, it's, it's pretty. I did, the one year I did elderberries with, clover honey and, Madagascar vanilla bean. And that was just insane. The vanilla was just enough that you thought it was like an oaked Cabernet, right? It's funny what we can do. Like sometimes the ersatz is better than the original if you do it right. Last question, and we'll let you go. What do you think about moringa trees?
I think they're fantastic. For the majority of the USA, they're just going to be kind of a hassle to deal with because they're a tropical tree and they're not going to survive winters most of the USA. So, and they're just not going to grow that big in their first year. So I think they're great. There's kind of limited application for the majority of the continental U.S.
They won't live in my land, right? So I'm in Fort Worth, just straight up 18 miles away from Dallas, right? Like, if they won't live here, then probably where most people live, they're not going to live. Now, if you're down in, like, south of Houston, down by Sugarland or something like that, South Florida.
Maybe. South Southern Florida, SoCal. I would say Southern Florida and Southern California.
And if you live in Southern Florida, you're not worried about what everything grows. I love people. I live in Zone 9A in Southern Florida. What can I grow? I'm like, what do you want to grow? Literally everything grows there. And then they'll inevitably want to do something like grow some northern variety of corn or something. You're like,
I want to grow Bing cherries.
Yeah. Okay. Grow your oranges and be happy. Let me get a t-shirt that says, grow your oranges and be happy. Anyway, Nick, thanks for being with us today. Again, if you want to get in touch with Nick, homegrownliberty.com and rareplantstore.com. He is putting together his schedule right now for consulting. If you want to try to make that not just a thing that you get, but a networking thing, I highly recommend the TSP Telegram group. There's like 6,000 people in that group. Odds are somebody there is close to you, and once you get two, sometimes three and four are much easier. So consider doing that. I know that Anton from Anton's Land of Biltong was very interested. Great. He's like, are you busy tomorrow? So I'm sure he'll be reaching out to you, and that puts him in my area, which I love because he always ends up spending at least one night here when he comes out this way. So if you guys are in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, it's a ground zero to bring Nick Ferguson into. Let him know. Get in touch with him. He'd be happy to help you out. Nick, thanks for being with us, and thanks for, you know, helping the community for, what is it, 13 years now.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
All right, guys, let's wrap up real quick here. First of all, and I do need to make some amendments to this post I did today because of some, I actually made some changes, but I need to make like one other change. The ChatGPT course for solopreneurs goes on sale at 10 p.m. Central Daylight Time tomorrow. So do your own conversions. If you are on the announcement email, you're going to get an email. The email is going to say, here's a link. You click the link, you go sign up. Initially, I was going to send the email at exactly 10 Central Time. I'm going to set it to go out at like 9:45 because my genius, Tom, did something I didn't know about till this morning after I wrote the post. He's got basically the page online ready to go right now, locked up with a timer on it that's saying how long until it becomes available. So by sending that email out a little bit early, it'll give everybody kind of an equal chance if emails come out of sequence or something like that to get there. We have, and I just checked it while I was talking to Nick there, 578 people that are pre-registered for a course with 100 seats. So whatever you got to do tomorrow, if you want in on the first round of this course, do it, because you know my workshops sell out sometimes 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes. This is going to be the same thing. This might be quicker because everybody's going to be there and ready to go, and you know, you don't have to travel to attend and what have you. This course is going to be off the hook awesome. As I developed it, I started thinking about developing it so that by the time we were done with it, my partner in all of this, Tom, would be better at the marketing side. And like, so I'm now developing this to help train my own partner in my business. And I think that says a lot about like the intent behind it. This was something that I've actually built this course like 8 times. Built it and said, that's crap. Rebuilt it. That's not good enough yet. Rebuilt it. And I just did the final revisions this weekend to be ready to put it on sale. When you sign up, if you get in, you're going to get emails for about 6 days. And then the next Monday, we will start the course. I think that's like the 9th of June that we'll actually start the course. And it will be once a day. There'll be a morning email posted to a private Telegram group. There'll be the instructions for that day. All day long, Tom and I will be checking in, answering questions. Students will be sharing their results, what they did to get better results, etc. This is going to be a journey of discovery. By the time you're done with it, you're going to have a blueprint for marketing your business, lead magnets, lead capture, content generation, and then there's some unadvertised bonuses. We're doing this for $100 a seat in this class. It will be at least $200 in round two. The only reason we're doing $100 in round one, and we haven't proven it yet, and I'm sure we'll make some mistakes. We'll absolutely make up for them, but that will make people a little more forgiving. We just talked about consulting and the value of a consultant. If you run a business and you hire a consultant that's good at what they do, not even great, just good at what they do, and they came in and did for you what this course will teach you how to do for your own business, you're looking at $10,000 to $20,000. $10,000 to $20,000. When I ran a consultant firm, our minimum retainer for people who wanted us to retainer was $5,000 a month. That was our minimum. And we probably had already hit them for like $20,000 to set them up and then $5,000 a month on a retainer. You can do this for yourself. It just takes some knowledge. And the tool that is AI today, one thing it's really, really good at is marketing. If you direct it properly, this is set up to help you do that. And I'll be giving away some stuff with this that I just say that most people wouldn't. And it's not about value. It's about disclosure of the back end. So just if you want in, be ready. Up today, though, again, is the item of the day is the Vivor 5-tray worm composter. This is the easy button for worm farming. It really is. And as I said yesterday when I talked about it, one of the easiest things you can do to get better results with growing your plants is worm compost. Worm compost and worm compost tea. What it does for plants is so beyond the nutrient level. The biology that you create in these systems is amazing. Vivor does some stuff really good, some stuff okay, and then some stuff is crap. I've always been honest about that. They're a Chinese company. A lot of these products are available under different brand names and things like that. This is one of them. But the equivalent brand name product of this version is like $25 more. So it's the exact same product. You read the write-up on it. There is, again, very few things you can do to improve your fertility and your biology beyond worms. Even if you're doing black soldier fly, the best thing you can do with black soldier fly frost is put it through a worm farm before you put it on your plants. So check this out. Consider getting one. They're only about $70, and you get another 5% off with my discount code. And remember, you can always help me out no matter what you're going to buy. If you just start at tspaz.com, you'll find all my reviews, links over to Vivor and Amazon. Discount code for anything at Vivor, and honest reviews of everything that I use from Amazon. Take care, guys. I'll catch you guys tomorrow with an expert counsel Q&A show for the week. Then we'll have a Friday flashback, and next week we'll do it all again.
They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you